Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the program host, guests, and participants, and not necessarily those of KKRN Community Radio and Acorn Community Enterprises, or the underwriters of this station. Hello, this is Dig This Environmental Watch. I am host Pamela Spoto, and in the studio today is our guest, Sarah Hoxie. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Pamela.
Also in the studio is Craig Boyer, who will be joining our discussion. Hello, Craig.
Hello, Pamela and Sarah.
Hi, Craig.
Our topic today is national monuments, parks, and protesters in the era of Trump. And I am so glad Sarah Hoxie is here to discuss this hugely important topic. I'm glad Craig's here, too. However, Sarah teaches environmental education at Chrysalis Charter School in Palo Cedro, and she's also a naturalist. And Sarah has spent much time in wilderness areas and on rivers. She knows, she sees what is happening in the environment. And we're also going to be talking about her travels through Utah, because that is directly relatable to what we are going to be looking at today. And there's a lot of information to cover here in this hour. We know that Trump has appointed people to the EPA and the Department of Interior who would just as soon, for example, do away with the EPA, as is evidenced by the lawsuits filed by the against the EPA by Scott Pruitt before he became head of the EPA. I mean, that is so convoluted, I have a hard time even saying it, that before Pruitt became head of the EPA, he was filing lawsuits against the EPA.
Yeah, the fox is in the hen house. There's no question about that. And that's happening all across the Trump administration.
It truly is, and it is outrageous. It's hard. I mean, as I was articulating that, it was just hard. It was like circular. It was hard to even say what it is. And then another appointment, Zinke, who is head of the Department of Interior, is a former Navy SEAL, okay, fine, and a one-term congressman who has no experience running a large decentralized bureaucracy and has relied heavily on his political appointees to run the day-to-day operations. And that information came from an article entitled Pillaging America's Parks, Trump's Department of the Interior has plans to loot our public lands. And it was written by Adam Fetterman. And this is where James Kaysen comes in. And I had never even heard the name James Kaysen. I think he's kind of underground, but he's not underground. And he is now the Associate Deputy Interior Secretary, and he is responsible for running the day-to-day aspects of, as I understand it, according to this article, of the Department of Interior. And I have a quote here of something that Kaysen has said, and I think it is so important. He said, "The Trump administration has inherited an anti-energy bias and a preservationist thought process that needed rooting out." So here is this person that is part of an agency, to help protect and manage our lands. And he's saying, you know, it's been way too anti-energy, and we can't have this preservationist thought process. This needs to be rooted out. And it's just amazing to me. And when they said that Trump inherited this, I'm thinking Obama was not anti-energy, but it was more of, let's look at some clean energy or some green energy rather than pursuing these fossil fuels, hydraulic fracturing.
I think one of the things that Obama never got credit for, which I think is really interesting, especially now, is, I mean, I really look at it as he kind of broke OPEC. He did it. And the way he did it was doing some really good things and doing some really bad things. And, you know, in fairness, I mean, he did a lot of fracking happened under his watch. And but also we became, you know, we became real, developed the wind and the solar in huge ways and became an exporter of energy. And once that happened, all the Saudis could do is to turn on the spigots and try and drive the price down. And that's when the price of gas dropped. And that's because, and some other really bad things happened, like famine in Venezuela, because they are also an OPEC nation. So it's not all roses. It did definitely change the economies, even in Saudi Arabia. But But Obama was responsible for that. And we became an energy producer and exporter under his watch, for good and for bad.
And I would also like to add that there's been a lot in the news about the tax reform bill that has passed. And I guess Trump is waiting until January to sign it, because then it won't come into effect until later. It's all kind of planned out about who's going to take the blame for it or the credit for it. But most of the tax relief, 83% goes to corporations and the rich, and these are permanent. And inside this bill, the reason I'm mentioning this is the go-ahead to drill in the Arctic. So, you know, we're talking about monuments, parks, and protesters, but also these wilderness areas, these areas that are fragile, that it would seem that this administration, this administration doesn't want to leave anything untouched in terms of growth and development. And this is what I don't understand, Sarah and Craig, is that, I mean, we have a finite planet. I mean, the planet doesn't expand. It's finite, you know. And we have this infinite idea that we can just grow and grow and grow and drill and frack and mine and log and graze cattle and do all of these things, throw away stuff, put plastic in the ocean. I mean, I don't quite understand that this whole notion of unlimited growth and then drilling in the Arctic is...
You know, it comes back, a lot of it, to education. I'll tell you a really interesting story. And this happened a long time ago, but it was so poignant. And what happened was, I was working in an outdoor school down in Mendocino, and there were a group of seventh graders, and they were from the Grass Valley area. And there was this girl, it was the end of the week, and the end of the week we all go out to the ocean and we stand, you know, we have a big picnic. And there was this girl, and she was standing way out by where the water was coming in, you know, way out there, and just having an experience in nature. And it was great. And I walked up to her and I said, "Hey, how was your week?" And she said, "Oh, it was really fun. I had so much fun." And she said, "But I have a question for you." And I said, "Okay." She said, What's out there?" And I said, "Out in the ocean?" She said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, if you go far enough that way, you're going to come to Hawaii. And then if you keep going, you're going to come to Japan." And she got real quiet. And then she said, "Why? I mean, how come I can't see Hawaii?" And I said, "Because the earth, you know, you're standing on the earth and it's this ball, it's round, and you can't see through a ball. If you were sitting on a tennis ball, you wouldn't be able to see, you know, through it because it's round." And she got real quiet again. And then she said, "The earth?" And I said, "The earth. You're standing on the earth." She said, "I thought it was up there." And she pointed up into the sky. And, you know, I realized that a lot of people may not have the connection that they actually are standing on the earth. That, you know, if you look at, like, National Geographic, a magazine now owned by Rupert Murdoch, but anyhow, when they write articles about the solar system, they'll capitalize Jupiter, Mars, and Venus, but Earth is in lowercase. So it's got, yes, so Earth has two definitions. Earth is, you know, the soil that grows plants, and Earth is the planet you live on. And, you know, we teach them separately. And it's very interesting. And I think a lot of people, Zinke and Trump, have no time to think about it. They are more interested in, you know, doing their thing, hiding their assets and making as much money as they can. They're not connected. They don't get it. They don't understand that they actually are standing on a planet.
Sarah, do you know Wayne Kessler?
I don't.
He had an organic transplanting business. He and his wife lived in Shingletown, in Manton. But they 2 years ago, they sold their business. And he was politically active, and he had worked in the Peace Corps. But he'd wanted to go into schools and tell children about plants and growing food. And so he did. And he said, "I would take tomato plants into a classroom, and he'd ask the students, where, you know, what is this?" And they could not identify it. They didn't link the tomatoes in the grocery store with the plant from the earth, from the soil. And it's so interesting. And I thought about that when you were talking, because it's not making those connections. It's not being, I don't know what to say, educated in that sense of where our food comes from, the planets, the ocean, geography, whatever the natural world. Mm-hmm. And that is a frightening thing when we become so disconnected.
No, it's interesting. If you take a globe, like a just a round globe, Earth model, and hold it up in front of a group of people and just put your finger on it and say, I'm going to move my hand out. And when I get to the edge of the breathable atmosphere, just tell me. And, you know, you start moving your hand out and somebody, after you're an inch or two away, somebody say, oh, stop. Or, no, keep going. People don't realize that you can't move your finger from the breathable atmosphere. It's only 5 miles thick.
I know.
And
that's nothing.
I tell kids, how many of you have ridden your bike 5 miles in the last, week? And all these hands go up. And I say, so if you just rode straight up, you would have ridden right out of the breathable atmosphere. Look at the top of Mount Shasta. You can see it with your eyes. That is, you know, coming close. Up there, if you just were to be beamed up there, you would definitely feel the lack of oxygen. You can see where it is. And people don't realize it. You know, you keep pumping stuff into it and carbon dioxide, and you offset the chemistry, it's going to change it. Because it's not a very big thing. It doesn't go to the stars, but people don't know that. They're not connected with it. They don't understand.
That is so interesting. I mean, and that certainly is true. And it doesn't go to the stars. I mean, and the fragility of that 5 miles of that space is overwhelming.
It's overwhelming and overfilling with CO2.
I know. And so I want to tell our listening audience that this brings us to our topic today. We wanted to set the framework for our discussion on monuments, parks, and protesters are involved in this in the sense that if you decide to take a stand and react to what is going on with our parks and monuments, you could be in a lot of trouble depending on what happens, even as a peaceful protester. So our topic once again today is that on December 4th, President Trump traveled to Utah to sign proclamations downsizing Bears Ears National Monument by 85%. 85%. When I heard that, I went, 85%? We're not talking about 5%, 10%.
I noticed that on a map they showed how it cut it up, and he cut up into little bitty parcels, so it's not even connected.
So the part that's left isn't even in one part. Mm-hmm. It's in parcels. Yes,
so tiny segments.
Oh, good, because then the mining operations can come in between those segments and drill down.
Right.
Oh, my goodness. And the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument by nearly 50%. And so that is what we're going to be focusing on. And in this last year, Terry Tempest Williams was at Shasta College, and she was talking about the number of parks and monuments that were on the chopping block. This just happens to be two that recently, this month, had this decision made. Now, there is the Antiquities Act, and I wanted to talk just a little bit about that. And I'm going to read what it says about the Antiquities Act here, that the Antiquities Act has given presidents the authority to set aside federal lands in order to protect historic landmarks, historic and prehistoric structures, and other objects of historic or scientific interest. And there are lawsuits that have been filed since Trump and his administration did this by Native American tribes and environmental organizations. And I guess part of the issue here is that presidents can set, they have the authority to set aside, as Obama did, certain spaces that are protected as monuments. But the president doesn't have the authority to what?
Undo it.
To undo it, to diminish it, to change it, that only Congress has that.
It's never been tried. I mean, there's no precedent for that. So it's going to be very interesting to see where it goes. One of the things that gives me hope, and, you know, I'm an optimist, so, you know, I'm going to keep on knowing there's got to be a silver lining, is that so many of these places have so many different agencies that oversee them that the tangle is huge. And to untangle that is going to be a lot of work for them. So we've got hundreds of, I'm not sure. I've got a list here of all the national monuments. Maybe, what did we say, 175? There's a bunch of them across the country. And they're all administered. You know, there's the BLM. It might have part of it. The Fish and Wildlife Service might have part of it. National parks might have part of it. You got to untangle all of that if you want to undo a national monument.
And unfortunately, with the Department of Interior headed up by Zinke and Kaysen, they oversee a lot of those right. sub-agencies. However, I also printed off a list. This had to do these particular, we talked about Native American tribes filing lawsuits, and these are some of the environmental groups that file lawsuits against Trump and the Department of Interior. The Wilderness Society, Defenders of Wildlife, Natural Resource Defense Council, Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, Grand Canyon Trust, Great Old Broads for Wilderness.
I want to join
say
that.
Say again.
That's from Durango, California. I mean, Colorado. Western Watersheds Project, Wild Earth Guardian, Sierra Club, Center for Biological Diversity. And those are just, some of them. So you're right. There are a lot of different groups, organizations that would need to untangle and tease out, you know, what is exactly going on here. Now, one thing that Trump said is that Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante, they had a long list of objects that the monuments were created to protect. But he said these objects are not unique, not of significant scientific or historical interest, and not under threat of damage or destruction. However, by reopening this, they're opening it to mineral leasing, mining, and other uses. How is that not damage or destruction?
Yeah, there'll be no one there to protect those antiquities. Those beautiful things are going to be destroyed.
Yes. Sarah, I know that we and Craig, we want to talk about the value of preserving these wonderful places. Is there anything that you want to say about Trump? Anything further you want to say about Trump's proclamations? But I know, Sarah, you have traveled, and I haven't been to Utah, and Sarah has been to Utah. Have you been to Utah?
Oh, yes, a number of times. Oh, yeah.
So maybe you both could tell us a little and a bit about Utah. And there's also the notion of Orrin Hatch and his group of Republicans that really want all the lands diminished that are protected to bring in leasing of fracking and mining and other kinds of hydraulic fracturing and so forth. Because what? Because it's more growth, more whatever, when we could be pursuing, I guess, some of these historical monuments with so many visitors, they create an enormous amount of income and contribution to the economy just by having them as protected and preserved.
And that'll be more and more as populations increase and people need an outlet.
Yeah, well, the recreational value of these is, you know, that's huge. My heart just goes to the Native Americans because a lot of these areas are protected because of the Native American artifacts and history, the historical significance. And that's what a lot of national park or monuments are created for, is for that cultural heritage. So, Utah, I mean, the times I've been through Utah, I told Pamela this morning, I've been across it twice on the Green River, which just kind of bisects it, and it goes through the Ute Reservation is on the south side, and it's just incredible. And there's Anasazi ruins, and there are corn cribs with I saw corn cribs with corn still in it, and the rows. Yeah, I mean, and just unbelievable petroglyphs and pictographs and burial sites, and the Utah is full. Of these kinds of archaeological areas that are very important to the Native Americans because, their history is alive and right there. I mean, that whole region is, you know, there's several different tribes there, and you know, it's their ancestry that's at stake. So I think there's been a lot of damage done to them, and I really feel for those folks. But yeah, there is so much in Utah, and I know why these places have been preserved. Edward Abbey wrote about Escalante, and long before it was ever a monument. So it's just the colors, the things that are there, the dinosaur tracks, you know, it's everything. It's amazing. It really is.
And that is so true. And I've seen wonderful pictures of Utah. And I mean, about the colors, I mean, it is just, it's incredible.
It truly is.
Incredible. I want to remind our listeners that this is KKRN.org 88.5. We're volunteer supported community radio. And I'm Pamela Spoda with Dig This Environmental Watch. And in the studio today is Sarah Hoxie, environmental educator from Chrysalis Charter School, and Craig Boyer. I just found just one statistic on visitors to parks. And in terms of the value of preservation, I was thinking about this quite a bit. And it said here that Congress has converted many monuments into national parks, including Arcadia, Grand Canyon, Arches, and Joshua Tree. But the point here is that these four parks alone, the ones that I just read, attracted over 13 million visitors in 2016. And it said that the aesthetic, cultural, scientific, spiritual, and economic value of preserving them has long exceeded whatever short-term benefit could be derived without legal protection.
It's interesting. Those guys, their idea of economic protection, I mean, it's consistent. Yeah, at least you got to give them a go for consistency, because, you know, they don't seem to get that if you don't have a climate you can function in, you really don't have an economy. And, you know, we're heading there. So I don't think that, you know, I think that it just extends this philosophy or this direction we're going with them. It kind of reflects that kind of short-sightedness of, you know, it's all about what you can squeeze out of oil and gas.
Immediately. And then the long-term effects are really negative.
Right.
So that's like you're describing, the economic value is huge, and they're not being realistic about it in the long term.
And so why do you think we need wild areas?
Spiritually, we need it because humans are connected to nature. We are part of nature, and without that, we are living in a concrete jungle instead of a beautiful space, and that's why we need it.
You know, I think we need it because in order to maintain the health of the overall ecosystem, we have to have parts of the ecosystem that function naturally. And you know, for example, migrating birds, they've got to have a place to be. And even if we didn't preserve it for us, we preserve a place for them, because as you know, as they continue their migrations, they need a place to stop and, you know, eat and sleep and rest before they take the next part of their journey. So just in terms of like the whole canary in the coal mine thing, where you've got to have a healthful environment for everything to survive, without those places, you know, those enclaves where things do survive. And we have preserved a lot in this country. We have so many areas that have different designations, and they're under different organizations, and they're, you know, they're preserved and protected. It's like I say, I don't think that Donald Trump, even in 4 years, if he lasts that long, can detangle enough to, you know, to take it all away. But he can do some serious damage. But we gotta have places where healthy things can live in a natural state, just for the health of all of us, and to preserve the biodiversity that we depend on to continue medicine, to continue moving forward as human beings. We you know, engineers, a lot of architects, people watch nature just to see how it functions in order to design habitable structures for human beings that actually are sustainable. We can learn a lot from it. We can't divide ourselves away from it.
And the same is true, for example, as I understand it, with the Amazon rainforest that is being, in terms of medicines, for example, that have been discovered, and future medicines that could be discovered, besides providing that habitat for all the wonderful sentient beings that live there. But the Amazon is slowly being cut down and burned for cattle grazing to provide cheap hamburgers for, you know, McDonald's chains in the U.S. And it doesn't make sense to me that we need these spaces. And Terry Tempest Williams, I mean, this seems like it should go without saying, but she says humans are not the only species on the planet. And I don't know whether we forget that, or people like Trump and the Trump administration thinking that humans are the only, well, rich humans.
Let's clarify.
Two species of
really
humans,
counts.
Rich humans and the rest of us.
and the tax reform bill shows that. It depicts that when you give 83% of the tax relief to the 1%. I mean, it's not about us as people and other beings. It's about, well, in my opinion, the oligarchs. So we, what you said is so true, that in order to provide habitat and in order to provide health for humans, in order to provide diversity, and studies have been done on depression, from mild to moderate depression, and going out into nature, into the wilderness, is as good and probably better, in my opinion, than taking antidepressants. Because there is a certain chemicals, and I don't know what these are, Sarah, that are given off by, let's say, trees, that when I'm out there breathing in and moving and oxygenating my lungs.
Oxygen is a great one to start with.
It's pretty important.
There is that. And so it can really make us feel better. But when we're stuck in, I would say, virtual reality, and this is my issue with cell phones and all of the devices that we have, is that if I get so stuck in that area of using the devices, I don't see what's going on around me. I don't. Terry Tempest Williams talks about writing a love letter to the parks, to the national parks, but none of that matters if I'm stuck in my phone. And I wrote a poem one time about, it's just going to be me and my cell phone, you know, my smartphone that's left. If we don't start paying attention to what is around us, the environment that's around us.
It's scary for me as a teacher when I see kids who really, I mean, at this point in time, an 8-year-old who is really kind of in between, like in this world and in a cyber world, because, you know, she or he, always looking at a screen and always thinking in terms of video games and always thinking in terms of, you know, of something that they've gotten from a screen, and just living their life kind of rooted in that reality. And, you know, they come to our school and we take them out. No, you can't bring your cell phone. Yes, we're going to go sit under an oak tree. But, you know, a lot of kids now never get that. And, you know, even here in Shasta County. I mean, you know what's amazing to me?
What?
And hands out up there, everybody out there listening, raise your hand if you've ever been to Yosemite. And if you haven't been, you have to go. You have to go.
Absolutely.
It's in your backyard, and it's absolutely an amazing place.
Well, I've been surprised that people living here haven't been to Mount Lassen.
Right.
That's astonishing. It's only like 45 miles away. And yet I've met quite a few people and found out, and they're adults, and they've never been. That's not good. Not good at all.
Yeah. And along this, before we take a break, along this similar vein, I had a student who drove from the college up here to Round Mountain. And he was telling me that he made the trip up here to see where the radio station was. And I said, oh, I said, how was it? And he goes, well, you know, there's nothing out there.
Oh, really?
And I just thought that is so interesting.
So because disconnected from our Earth.
When I drive up here, I'm looking at the shape of the land, the water, what the trees are doing at this time. It's one of the prettiest drives, one of the most dangerous roads, but one of the prettiest drives, you know, and different times of the year, it's absolutely gorgeous, but there's nothing here.
He's,
you know, you gotta have the vocabulary. I'm not saying he doesn't have vocabulary, vocabulary to assign to this. So if he knew when he saw the limestone in that canyon down there that's limestone, you know, then all of a sudden, and then if you know the significance of limestone and where it comes from and then what it indicates for the area, then your mind opens up and you go, wow, there's probably caves here. This probably was under the ocean at one time. And if you have that background, and this is what I mean by if people aren't connected with the earth and they don't know these things, then you can't go anywhere if you don't know that.
That is totally true. And I don't know if because of being in this half virtual reality and half in what non-virtual reality, if that is even being, how does one get that awareness? You know, what you just explained, does that come from school? Does that come from parents, you know, teaching their children? I mean,
it comes from being out in it.
It comes from being out
and
in it.
And being curious.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
that's
yes.
True.
You know, you've got to be curious. And, you know, it's, and for, you know, for just in deference to, you know, education, the next generation science standards really push that inquiry and that questioning and try to stimulate that curiosity. So, I mean, you know, science education is trying to go there, especially with younger kids, and get them interested and get them asking questions. That you have to be able to ask those questions to be interested and passionate.
So before we take our break, maybe we could sum up what is the value of these wilderness areas, of keeping these wilderness areas and these monuments and parks protected. And, you know, we talked about the economic value, since that seems to be very important to a lot of people, of having, 13 million visitors to only four parks in 2016. And also in terms of what Sarah and Craig were saying, in terms of our own health as people, for enjoying the beauty, the diversity of these places, and experiencing other species when we go out and we see. Is there something else that you want to say about this?
My greatest concern is that they're charging to go into these parks. And, of course, they're talking in terms of $70 per admission, which means that people who are not wealthy are going to be shut out from this experience. To me, these national parks are as a cathedral. And I think of the cathedrals I've been in, and I didn't have to pay to go into those cathedrals. And as I was, until about Richard Nixon, there was no charge to go into these cathedrals, as I call them, these national parks and national monuments. After that, they started to be, well, we'll just charge a little bit just to cover this expense. And it has increased and increased and increased to the point that only the more wealthy people can even enjoy this now. This should not be. It should be free as it was.
Totally agree with you. And, you know, the other side of this $70 fee increase that they want to bring the parks to is that it'll also drop participation. And then they'll be able to say, well, you know, not that many people are going to the park. So why don't we just sell off some more of the people's land?
Well, really, though, you know, we need more money for the military.
if you believe that, I've got a bridge
got
in
a
San
bridge.
Francisco to
I've
sell
got,
you.
I've got one in Reading.
yeah, exactly.
I mean, the trillions of dollars that go into the killing machine, the military-industrial complex, but also this 83% of this new tax reform bill that's going to the oligarchs, I think in the first year, is adding to the national debt, I think $1.5 trillion, but over a period of a few years, $5 trillion are going to go back to the wealthiest people in the United States. So all of this, we have money. That is the thing. We can have these services and places that are for the people. We could have free education. We could have health care. We could have
not
charge for parks. We have the money, but the money goes to the strangest places. I mean, the trillions of dollars goes into the war machine. The trillions of dollars goes back to the wealthy. I mean,
it pools up there. I mean, I am not seeing it.
Yeah. It's not trickling down.
Not trickling down.
It needs to do more than trickle down. And even if it were to trickle down, it needs to do more than that. But
it's just pooling up. I mean, the economists since Reagan, who initiated this trickle-down economy, have said, you know, it's a farce. It didn't trickle down. It didn't trickle down, and Reagan's administration had to raise taxes again because it was getting so bad during that time. And to reenact that idea, to give this talk about the greatest wealth shift in U.S. history going to the top 1%. I mean, this is incredible. And we're just talking about, what, $70, you know, a fee to get into
that's ridiculously expensive
for a lot of people. That's a lot of money for me.
I know, and me too. So there should, once again, there should be money available for us, the regular people, the people that are working, raising their families, trying to do good work, and taking care of business, you know? We should get some relief here, too.
And I want to say something else about preserving the national. Do you need to take a break?
We are in a minute, but go right ahead.
Oh, about the national monuments, and one of the reasons we need them is because they are put there for historical purposes. And, you know, you're supposed to learn from history. And, you know, we're clearly not doing a very good job of that. I mean, Reagan wasn't that long ago.
If you've seen one tree, you've seen them all.
Right, exactly.
But we have this amnesia, this historical amnesia, and it wasn't that long ago.
No, it wasn't. But if we get rid of the national, or if we start eliminating national monuments, you know, then the historical information that those teach the general public is going to be lost. And that, you know, it just exacerbates this problem. It just makes it worse.
That is true. And so we are going to take a break, and we're going to listen to Bob Wickline, because I really like Bob Wickline, and it's Take Your Heads Out of the Sand. Also, we were looking for one of Sarah Hoxie's CDs, because she also sings and plays about these kinds of issues that we're talking about here today and all of her travels out into wilderness areas. So this is KKRN.org. And Environmental Watch, and we're going to be back in just a couple of minutes. And I think when we come back, we should talk about the International Darkness Association, because I see this as an important issue for parks as well as for humans. So we'll be right back.
I had a dream the other night. Now, in my dream, our national bird had become the ostrich. How much can she take? How much can she give? How much is too much, and how much longer can she live? As we turn our backs and turn our eyes and pretend we don't see, if ignorance is bliss, then full of bliss are we. As we take, 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 take. Like a good mother, Mother Nature keeps giving, but her heart must be ready to break. She's being abused and overused by her children who choose to ignore. There's only so much that she can give before she can give no more. Let's take our heads out of the sand and open up our eyes. Let's take our heads out of the sand and finally realize that our tomorrows will depend on what we do today. Let me not greed lead the way. We poison the air, we poison the land, and we poison the water we drink. And we're the only known creatures in the whole universe with the ability to think. But we keep on thinking, happiness lies in how much we buy and sell. And more of paradise is lost, and only time will tell what will become of Mother Nature in the coming years, when we will have about 10 billion neighbors on the sphere. Will our children's children wake up to the American dream? Or will it have become a nightmare beyond imagining? Let's take our heads out of the sand and open up our eyes. Let's take our heads out of the sand and finally realize that our tomorrows will depend on what we do today. Let me not greed lead the way. So
and waste so much? How much do we really need? And how long can a dream survive that seems to thrive on greed? A little pollution is so thick and dark and dense. It contaminates and poisons common good and common sense. Let's take our heads out of the sand and open up our eyes. Let's take our heads out of the sand and finally realize that our tomorrows will depend. How much can she take? How much can she give? How much is too much and how much longer?
Welcome back to KKRN, and this is Environmental Watch, and I'm Pamela Spoto, host of this show. Bob Wickline ends that, he just ends it so abruptly. I like it, but it catches me off guard sometimes. And we're in the studio with Sarah Hoxie and Craig Boyer, and we're talking about national monuments, parks, and we're going to get to protesters too. And I said before break that we wanted to, I want to, and I think we all want to talk about the International Darkness Association. And I really hadn't heard that much about it. And I was listening to an interview with Jennifer Jewell out of Chico with some representatives from this organization. And a lot of people, I think, don't think about darkness. And I know, and we're told as human beings that we need sleep at night, uninterrupted sleep as much as possible, which is kind of difficult sometimes because this is the repair time, And Sarah, you brought up migratory birds, and this affects them, I mean, obviously, as well. So, and we're all, it's also suggested that humans turn off the television, turn off the light, so they get the darkness, so the melatonin and can be released, and we can get a good night's sleep, we repair our bodies. But the more light, and in cities, I mean, incessant light that is there really creates havoc. And cell phones, I mean, my students will say, oh, yeah, man, I check 2 o'clock in the morning to see messages, you know, during the night. And that blue light is one of the, I mean, research is showing that it is not the healthiest light for your eyes and it interrupts sleep. And there are other possibilities that are going on with that. But with this these representatives from the International Darkness Association was saying that plants respond to length of night to set flowers. Wildlife and pollinators need darkness in their habitats. And that certain migratory birds fly in the darkness of the night in order to do what they do. And so this is very, very important. Now, I'm thinking about monuments and parks, for example, and wilderness areas that you open up to, let's say, uranium mining or hydraulic fracturing. And it is just obscene when they start setting up these, and I've seen, you know, in multiple photographs and videos of setting up hydraulic fracturing platforms, and you have trucks, I mean, 24 hours a day that are hauling in water, nice clean water, and then hauling out half the produced water. The other half of the produced water stays in the ground, which is toxic. And there are lights on this equipment. So what is that going to do to these protected areas or that were once protected areas? I mean, to have that much light pollution, there's light pollution and noise pollution. And I don't know whether people are even that familiar with these environmental hazards.
Well, and they're huge issues. I mean, the sound pollution in the ocean completely confuses the whales and the, you know, the sea mammals.
Blows up their brains. Some of the Navy sonar that they are putting out in the oceans, and they're wondering why whales' brains are bleeding. I mean, this is terrible.
Yeah. So, I had an ornithology teacher at Feather River probably about 40 years ago who talked about going onto the rooftops in Reno then and finding just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of birds that had crashed into the tops of the building. So it's a big, big problem. And, you know, the birds migrate at night because they, you know, use the starlight to migrate by. And so, and then they're drawn in by the lights of the big cities.
Oh,
it's amazing we have any migratory birds left in those areas because they're sucked right into, you know, Reno and Las Vegas. Sacramento, anything with a lot of lights. But Reno and Las Vegas are really big because that's what
sure.
Nevada has, are those big, huge casino cities.
That truly is amazing, and things that we don't, I think, as a population normally think about. And the more that we want to mine and frack and drill next to these protected areas or in these protected areas or opening certain protected areas to hunting because Trump's son is an avid hunter. Right. Is there any place, see, this is what really bothers me, is there any place sacred that needs to be protected in the eyes or the minds of people that just see this as something we can take and use?
It's a commodity.
It's a commodity.
It only protects Trump Tower.
Oh.
Which has a controlled environment. I want to add, when it gets really hot outside, they just crank up the air conditioning.
That's right.
So this brings us to two final points here, and it's kind of interesting. We only have about 15 minutes left, and there is a person that I respect his position and his knowledge, and I'm friends with him on Facebook, and he's also a professor, and he said that environmentalists really need to compromise with corporations and businesses because, you know, the environmentalists are really seen as pretty, can be seen as really pretty, radical. And I've been thinking a lot about this notion of compromise. And one of my favorite DVDs, and I don't know whether either one of you has seen it, but that doesn't matter, is called Gasland. And I think there's a part two, it's by Josh Fox, and it's about hydraulic fracturing. But what was so interesting is they interviewed all these people in terms of mineral rights under their land that they didn't own. I mean, some people signed off, oh yeah, give me $10,000 per acre and you can do whatever you want on my property. And others, they had farms or they had little mini ranches, but they didn't own the mineral rights. And so I was sitting on my little deck in the country on my 5 acres this morning, and I was thinking, hydraulic fracturing, what would happen just across my fence? This huge platform comes in, and it's usually not just one platform for hydraulic fracturing. And what is given off into the atmosphere is toxic. What goes into the aquifer is toxic. What goes into the soil is toxic. And so this woman that was being interviewed by Josh Fox said, you know, I was told we had to compromise. And she said, we've compromised. I can't compromise anymore. She said, I'm sick. My family is sick. And that she can't sell her property because no one wants to buy this contaminated property. Her water is toxic. And so she goes, what am I supposed to do? And the companies will say, we didn't contaminate the aquifer here. We didn't contaminate the well. So you have anecdotal stories of a well being good for 30 years. A hydraulic fracturing platform is established. That well now has natural gas in it. And how you know is that you can go into your kitchen and you have a match and you can light your water on fire. And they're saying, the companies are saying, well, you can't prove that. And so people were drinking this water before they knew that it was so highly contaminated. And so this woman compromised. What did the corporations do? I don't see compromise on their part. And I was also thinking, why should I compromise like pesticides on my food? You know, 50% of my food, that's okay to have. I'll compromise. I'll take 50% of my food with pesticides or herbicides. But see, I don't have to because I can grow organic food. I don't have to eat pesticides. I am not going to compromise. That my health. Why should I do that? And so it's just it's really kind of an interesting dilemma here that about wanting to take ATVs into wilderness areas, wanting to pick up whatever I have and carry it out, and the light pollution and the noise pollution, and wanting to hunt in these areas. This is a compromise. I don't agree. I mean, what do you think? I mean, how much can we compromise here to protect these other species?
Well, the compromising, we've been compromising for years, and now we're compromised.
Mm-hmm. Well
I mean,
put.
That's
well
where
put.
The word comes from.
Been fracking, and then the water is contaminated to where it can't be drunk, and that's rather permanent, very long term. So, yeah, we can't compromise on those
But
things.
I'll give you $10,000.
No, not worth it.
Oh.
Got a drink. Got to have water.
Yes, and I think that that is what the Native American population in North Dakota was saying. Water is life. Mm-hmm. And you will know, and not you will know, but I think I should note here that in Standing Rock, saying that water is life, we have to protect our water. Pipelines leak. Energy Transfer was saying, oh, no, it's safe. And after they've pushed through, I mean, it's one leak after another, but Standing Rock, peaceful protesters who were praying were met with armored vehicles, riot gear, sound cannons. And I'm wondering, do sound cannons blow out your eardrums, or can they blow out your eardrums? Police dogs biting, pepper spray, tear gas, shotguns. And I mean, when you see the photos, you see Native Americans standing there, you might see a horse or two, and then you see these armored vehicles and sound cannons. It's really incredible. And so that's kind of what people are facing when they're trying to stand up for the land and the water.
And then in North Dakota, they after Standing Rock, they went ahead and floated six bills to try and criminalize protesting, and four of them passed. And, you know, they're making it very difficult for people to be able to just exercise that right to be able to stand up and protest.
And, I mean, people are facing felony conspiracy charges. They are, you know, faced with other kinds of prosecution. There are prison sentences, huge fines, property forfeiture to pay for law enforcement time and so forth. So the right to peaceably protest means, I mean, what does it mean? I mean, if we were, like I was asking Sarah this morning, we were talking about this. Let's say there are 500 protesters, and then six people come in and break some windows, okay? If we are caught, we are held responsible for that window breakage. And just for the record, during Trump's inauguration, I guess there were, and I have it down here because I was just amazed by it, that that there was some minor vandalism of smashing six windows by a small group of people, and 200 protesters are facing felony charges and up to 70 years in prison. That's 70 years in prison. Now, if this is not to squash protesting, you know, I don't know what is. Because you don't know, especially, and it has been recorded, especially during the 60s and the Black Panther Party, but also with peaceful people who are protesting for peace and against war, that they've been infiltrated by the CIA or the FBI. And we know that provocateurs, and this really came out with the Black Panther Party during the 60s, that so somebody comes in that is not even part of that protest and breaks a window, and then we are held responsible. So, this is a very difficult situation. I mean, what do we do?
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things we do is we need to turn the tide on who our lawmakers are, and try and get some of those people out of office. I mean, here we go. So, like, it is now almost January, and the midterms are in November. So they can do a lot of damage between then and now, but the inertia is definitely there. If we can get past the gerrymandering, and, you know, that's a big question as to what the Supreme Court's going to say about that.
Well, gerrymandering is an interesting, that whole issue is highly interesting. And I think after what happened in Alabama, with the black vote coming out so strongly against Moore, and he lost to Doug Jones. I mean, there has been, that happened in Florida where the blacks were disenfranchised from voting. And so I wonder how this is going to play out, knowing that certain groups of people will vote in a certain way. And so the Congress or whomever at that point tries to eliminate or reduce that voting bloc.
Right. Voter suppression. So, you know, we've got voter suppression, we've got gerrymandering. Those things are, you know, both tied up in the courts in so many ways. And the big question is now coming down to the Supreme Court, who already said you cannot gerrymander for racial reasons. So then they turned around and resubmitted, and whether can we do it for political reasons? Well, can we just say, hey, these are all Republicans, so we're going to make this really wonky looking district so we can get all their votes and split these Democrats up so that they won't have the power? And, you know, that's a really interesting question. That's up against the Supreme Court. And I have, you know, in years past, I would have held out a lot of hope. Now, you know, just holding my breath to see what's going to happen. And, you know, voter suppression, too, so many ways. I mean, in Texas, from what I understand, a gun registration is a legitimate form of identification. But like your Meals on Wheels card is not, and your student body card is not. I mean, you know, I don't know. It's so blatant.
It's so blatant.
But, you know, and then just the kibosh on protesting. It's, you know, the rights that are given to us in the Constitution, the rights that we have as Americans is being eroded, and taking our land away and giving it to corporations, and taking our money and giving it to corporations. And that's what the tax bill was. Mm-hmm. That's what this whole land grab is all about.
Yes.
Is taking our land, which that land belongs to all of us. That's my land. That's your land. That land belongs to this land belongs to. Yeah. You know the song.
Yep.
And, you know, they're taking our land and they're saying, you know, big companies, big corporations, we're going to give you extra tax advantage so you can build more platforms, and then good luck. Here's your land. It's pretty, you know, it's a pretty uphill battle for America. But I still hold out hope that, you know, we can turn this around. We can. But we just have to have to get enough people out.
And to become as informed and as aware as we can. We only have maybe 3 minutes left, and I want to make sure that you have said everything that you would like to say about this topic. And I'd also like to read a couple of things from Terry Tempest Williams. Should I?
I think you should go for Terry Tempest Williams. She knows how to put it all into a nutshell, for sure.
No, yeah, and I could read. I have like an 8-page document here, but obviously in 2 minutes, I'm only going to
can't
pick.
Make a nutshell out of that. But you can try.
The title of this article is Terry Tempest Williams on her National Parks Love Letter, Trump Era Activism. And it you know, she said what you were just saying, Sarah, that she was going to write this book. And what I thought I was writing was about our national parks and our public commons. What I ended up writing about was the history of America and falling deeply in love with the country we call home. And then she's asked, what does it mean to be an environmentalist? And she says, I think it means to care about where one lives. I think it means to consider a broader definition of community to include all species, not just our own. I think it means to consider every act and how it's complicit in the wider world in terms of an ethics of place. And I think it means to walk in wildness so we don't forget where the source of what it means to be human can be found. And then finally, she says, I think this direct assault demands direct action, and also what it means to be an environmentalist, to dare to speak truth to power. And that's why I wanted to touch on protest and protesters, because we do take a grave risk depending on how we do that. And so I think. Oh, and I think I'll just read this last sentence here, and then we're going to have to for sure wrap up. She says, but what I love is that I called the Department of Interior. Close to 3 million citizens responded saying, keep your hands off our national monuments. We want them protected. We do not want them reduced or rescinded. Mm-hmm. And so the more people that can speak
Absolutely.
Out, speak up. For the love of wildness.
We need an empowered citizenry. That's what we need.
We certainly do. And I really want to thank you both for being here today. Sarah Hoxie, environmental educator at Chrysalis Charter School, and Craig Boyer, who is always with us. And I'm very grateful for that. And I'm Pamela Spoto, poet and host of Environmental Watch. Dig this, Environmental Watch. And this is KKRN in Bella Vista, Round Mountain, community-supported radio. And by the way, next Saturday, a week from this Saturday, is the fifth Saturday of the month, and we're going to have EcoShock. Dig This is hosted four Saturdays of the month, but when we have a fifth one, we just pull in EcoShock, and that's a good thing, too. Mm-hmm. So bye for now.